ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today I'm interviewing the head of strategy and research for Loop Reclame and our first guest from Sao Paulo, Brazil, Thiago Pinto. Thiago is an audio engineer who's passionate about the crossroads of media, technology, and behavior, and who holds an interest in consumer behavior, personal data economy, reality mining, music psychology, creative radio, audio documentary, synthesizers, and retrofuturism. Thiago, thank you so much for joining us today. You wrote a blog piece in Medium about the music industry that I read, and it prompted me to search you out so that we could share your insights about music and then talk about the similarities and differences between the change happening in the music industry and the video entertainment industry.
Yeah, so my point on the article that I wrote is about a big change that I see in the way that people consume music. If we look back in time to the beginning of times and music was already present, we see that people used to have a spiritual relation with music. Music was used in celebrations, spiritual celebrations among tribes all over the world. And if we fast forward to the classical period of music, we see that during that time, music was used as a social tool, a way of people to differentiate themselves to the society. And then if we jump again in time and we go to that period after the Second World War and the beginning of consumption societies, music and all cultural goods, they started to play a key role in people's lives as a way for them to differentiate themselves. So at that time, the things that you bought, or the things that you listened, the things that you wear, were fundamental keys to telling what groups did you belong, what kind of social or political orientation someone would have. And then when we again do a big jump and we see the way that music is consumed today, we see that the digital revolution and the access to information that was made available, suddenly you wouldn't have to limit yourself to your music collection or to whatever the radio was playing. You had access to the whole music library of the world, you know. So people started to jump from one genre to the other, started to experiment, and they started to use music in a very practical way in their daily lives. So when you ask someone today, what kind of music do you like? They're usually going to say, well, I like all sorts of music. For example, I like house music when I go to the gym. Or I like jazz when I'm cooking at home with my family. So you see that people started to use music in a very practical way. We cannot be blind to all this change.
A lot of the executives or big speakers will say, you know, people's emotional relationship with music hasn't changed, and we still love music the way we always did. And while it seems like, yeah, in some ways, but there's also been a really significant change. And to ignore that change, to ignore how people are consuming it, to ignore how that's changed, is to really fail to see what that might mean for the economic models, understanding the consumer, and then if their relationship or consumption model has changed, there are real obvious implications.
And I think that from the business perspective, the ones that understood this change are the ones that are thriving today. You take Spotify, for example, which is a service that it's heavily based on playlists, and not genre playlists, but mood playlists. So that shows a lot of how they understood this this transition, and they made that into a feature in their product. And and you see how important playlists are today in the Spotify business model.
Right. Well, it's interesting because I think there are certain parallels between video entertainment and musical entertainment.
I think that more and more, and this from an artistic point of view might hurt some people, but more and more everything is just content. You know, like music is fighting for the same attention as print, as video, as games. It's all content, and everyone is fighting for time, which is our most valuable asset. And in this fight, I think that music has a big advantage, which is the fact that its consumption is passive. Mm-hmm. Which goes along the things that I wrote about the practical function of music. Music can be consumed with video. If you're, for example, watching sports, you can, you know, listen to some music if you don't mind to not listen to the narrator. If you're playing games, you can listen to music. If you're reading, you can listen to music. And this is a big advantage. But as I said, from the artistic point, what does that mean for music as an art form? It means that people are not actually being active when right. they're listening to music. And from the art point of view, is like, is this something really good?
Am
I making something? It's like, is my music touching people in some way? Like the feelings that me as an artist, like I put my tears and my sweat to make this album is about my, you know, my life and whatever.
And it's just your background music.
And it's just your background music. And again, like to show a little bit of this, I was doing some research on numbers comparing Netflix and Spotify, which are the two biggest players in their industries. For example, Netflix has more than 83 million members watching 125 million hours of content daily. That's an average of 1.54 hours per day.
Wow.
Spotify has only has about 100 million users, counting the ad-supported ones, and their daily average is 2.5 hours.
Wow, that's
so you see there's
right.
and when you think about it, like from a consumption point of view, those Netflix users are actively consuming. And Spotify users are passively consuming, because when you look at the hours that Spotify is more popular, you see that it's during work hours.
Right. Well, it's funny. I think about my own, and I'm listening to Spotify when I'm commuting, and I'm listening to I listen to different playlists when I'm working, you know, the superior study playlist or something like that. That's fascinating. I'd never really parsed it that way, to think about the passive consumption and active consumption. And of course, from video, everybody wants to do that highly engaged user. Although, television at one point, certainly there are all sorts of people out there who the television was and still may be, company. You know, that they wouldn't really be paying attention to the program, but it was on.
Yeah, that's true.
On in the background. And yet that is where people are leaving that model. And it's interesting that you're right in that music has a huge advantage in that if everything is content and everybody is fighting for available time, that music can be layered on top of other consumption of content. And so it has an advantage in terms of, if we're purely monetizing consumption hours, there are more hours available to music than, let's say, video. However, in terms of engagement, and if somebody is then going to go out and buy that ticket to the show, or that, I don't know, t-shirt or what have you, maybe it's harder to get to that point because people are being so passive about it.
Yeah, I think that's listening to you, one thing that came to my mind is maybe that, for example, Netflix series, the consumption is engagement. Of course, you can track people's social behavior and comments and everything, but that also happens with music. But if you look at what the sort of engagement that labels look for these days is purchase, like merchandising and tickets. This is the sort of like, okay, I put the content out there for me to get this kind of engagement. When you do a Netflix series, that's pretty much the end. I'm not sure if they sell lots of merchandise of, for example, House of Cards. I'm not sure about that one. But this is something to think about. And Netflix is very good at creating a huge buzz. And the consumption of their original series is it's much higher during the first days or weeks than it is after 2-3 months. So they have like that long tail of consumption. When you look at music, it's different. Of course, you do have a big impact of the release date, but people keep coming back. And if you, for example, I was looking at some numbers from Drake, for example, which is the biggest artist in Spotify. And I think his last album, Views, was released like, what, 3 months ago or something like that? Maybe a little bit less. But if you look at his numbers, his monthly listeners on Spotify, they keep increasing.
Oh.
So, you know, I don't have an answer, but how can video learn from that? How can you have a viewership that it's constantly increasing, like music or like the big artists in music? They have, for example, when you look at these numbers, for example, from Drake, you're considering the whole catalog of his music. But if we look, for example, to House of Cards, and we look at the catalog, which is season 1, 2, 3, and 4. I think it's 5 now. I'm not sure.
I don't know.
But anyway, so this is their catalog. Is the first season still being watched by that many people? Well, this is we would need to have the numbers to be more precise on that one. But I think this is something to have in mind. You know, how can video create a way to engage people, to make them come back. And I think there's some new things happening in the music industry that could be something to be applied. Yeah, to pay attention to and to be applied to the video industry and to the music industry in general as well. Kanye West, for example, and his last album, Life of Pablo, which is still being tweaked. You know, he's adding music, editing music. So you never, I think we still don't know if the album is finished. He's creating a dynamic piece of art, you know, like,
right.
So
it's a dynamic user experience. And so they feel
that's
more
it,
engagement.
Because it's the first album that he doesn't release physically. So if it lives only in the digital world, why does it have to be the same throughout the whole history, you know? Why can't he change?
Well, can you imagine then if you were to have narratives that shifted over time, you would engage people. It's an interesting to think how, from a practical standpoint, you would execute that.
Yes.
But how engaging it would be.
Yeah, that's it. And I think that, of course, you have to have that mindset when you begin developing a series, for example. But once you do that, you always have a lot of material that it's recorded and never goes to the final cut. That could be a way for you to have a prolonged consumption of a content, like a video content.
Right.
The same way that music does. Music does it today already because it's a different form, of course.
Right.
But I think that this lesson from Kanye, it's interesting because if you apply to the video industry, maybe you can actually create the necessity for people to buy things again, because if that's a limited version, and I really enjoy that one, I want to have it.
Right. Well, that's fascinating. I'm also curious if one of the things that we really notice in film and video entertainment is a difference in the way people consume entertainment based on their age. Do you notice in music a difference in the way millennials interact with music? You know, these young people who have always had increased access to the means of making music themselves, increased access in terms of finding different kinds of music, the democratization of all of it, and yet also not having as curated, the labels aren't sort of feeding it to them, or the radio stations aren't the only source. So these people who've grown up in this new world order, do they behave and interact differently, or is it pretty uniform regardless of age?
Well, I think that for these kids, well, they are not actually kids, but these young millennials, being born with all this access, I think that they don't have a music preference anymore. I think that's the big thing, because it's not about the music that you like; it's about the music that suits the mood or suits the moment. So.
So you really think that people don't have that? I mean, I agree totally about mood. I think that you've nailed something which is really, really interesting. And yet I still think that there's music I like, but of course I'm older than a millennial, so maybe I'm still part of that, you know, old age home, have my music that I like. I mean, is it they really, really don't have music that they really like? Or
I think if we go back to the numbers I said before, where an average Spotify listeners listens to 2.5 hours of music a day, if he listens to one of his he or she listens to one of their favorite albums, that's gonna be 40 minutes of that whole 2.5 hours experience. So I think that yes, they are still listening to the music that they like, and they still have their favorite artists and their favorite music. But if you look at the consumption as a whole, you'll see that it doesn't reflect this love and this fascination for some artists. It doesn't. Again, this is not for everyone, and this is something that people got really picky on me after I wrote, because I said that, I said that people don't love music anymore, and I'm not trying to, you know, make such a big statement like that. I'm just saying that we should look of how it's
how
changing.
How they love the music.
Yeah, because they're not loving the music 100% of the time, you know, they are loving the music maybe 30-40% of the time, and the other 60% they are just listening because they are doing something else. I'm quoting a lot of Spotify information because I think that they made some cool stuff available. If you look at they published a chart showing the number of listeners across the main genres, and you see that the one with the most, they were trying to to show loyalty, fan loyalty. So which are the most loyal fans?
Right.
Not surprisingly for me, who grew up in the music business world, or you know, from playing to then working. It's metal. It's heavy metal. They were always the craziest fans. You know, the ones that you don't understand where they came up. Like, you know, like you go to a heavy metal gig from a band from Iceland here in Brazil, and there's gonna be people there that that know those guys, like they know their family, you know. So these guys are really, really attached to the genre. But then if you look at the other genres that come right behind heavy metal, you have rock, pop, hip hop, classical, in like with the same amount of loyalty, let's say. So I, knowing that most of Spotify users are millennials, I can't believe that they love classical. I think that they use classical. Right. You know, it's good. Some of them might be loving classical, and that's fantastic because of access. You know, access gives you that, gives you new new information, and you can start loving something that you never thought you would. Beautiful.
Right. But are you engaged? Are you going to go support your orchestra? Are you going to go and do those things? That's really, really, that's such a good insight, I think. Because, of course, the musicians in these things, you know, need to make a living. People need to go see them live or else they can't continue to do it. I mean, I think that's one of the things that, what is it? I've read some book title. It was Artists Have Day Jobs or something like that.
Yeah, that's totally true. For the 99% of them, it's true.
Before we wrap up, I always like to just sort of do some rapid fire, like give me your first word impression of some of these things. So whatever comes to mind first, say. Facebook.
I don't use it.
Google.
They know all about my life.
Snapchat.
Not for me.
Twitter.
I should be a bigger user, but I'm not.
YouTube.
It's part of my daily routine, I think.
One of the things that's interesting is I think YouTube is actually the largest music source out there.
It is. It's the biggest music streaming platform, although it's a video one.
Yeah, well, it's interesting though, because if I'm ever trying to find music for a client project or something, and we want to quickly share a song with somebody else, we'll YouTube it. We'll look for it that way, rather than some of these music sites. I never think of YouTube as being music, but then it turns out that indeed it is. How important is social media to music?
So I think that social media gives the artists a different kind of content to share with their fans, and I think that that's really important, because with this massive production of content that we have today, it's really easy to be forgotten. So you have to be constantly knocking on people's door and say, oh, look what I have for here for you. I have a new song. I have a new video. Come and check it out. Because there's just too many music out there.
Right. And so it's sort of the key to the engagement, not just listening, but engaging. That's
yes.
Where the differentiation is.
Yes, that's very well put it, because as we said, a lot of the times that people might be listening and not engaging.
Right.
And when you deliver a different kind of content, video or especially video, they are gonna actually engage. So
right.
Yeah.
A big thank you to our guest and new friend, Tiago Pinto. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.